Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to the Children's Justice Project monthly training series. This training is offered to key stakeholders involved in Wyoming's juvenile court system and held every second Tuesday of the month from 12 to 1 p.m. To obtain the materials electronically for today's training, please visit the Children's Justice Project website at www.courts.state.wy.us/initiatives/CJP and then click the training tab in the middle of the screen. If there are any questions, participants are welcome to call in during the last 10 minutes of the training session. The call-in number is area code 917-889-8064. One may also post questions and comments using the online chat session on the Blog Talk Radio website. We hope you'll find today's training informative and would like to thank you for your attendance.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Edie Troutwine, Children's Justice Project Coordinator with the Wyoming Supreme Court, and thank you for joining Blog Talk Radio today. The title of our episode is The New Federal Indian Child Welfare Act, ICWA Regulations. Today's presenter is Adrienne Smith. She is an attorney and will provide an overview of the new ICWA regulations, which took effect on December 12th of 2016. The Indian Child Welfare Act was enacted in 1978 in response to a crisis affecting Indian children, families, and tribes. Studies have revealed that large numbers of Indian children were being separated from their parents, extended families, and communities, and placed in non-Indian homes. Through ICWA, Congress established minimum federal standards to be applied in state child custody proceedings. ICWA requires state courts to utilize these federal standards to determine almost all of the key issues that must be decided in child custody proceedings when a child can be removed or parental rights terminated, what constitutes consent to adoption and placement of the child in both adoption and foster care proceedings. Compliance with the ICWA requirements has been uneven across the country, and certain provisions have been interpreted differently from one state to another. For that reason, the Department of Interior issued new guidelines clarifying how the act should be applied, and binding regulations have now been issued. Addie's presentation will provide information about key sections of the new ICWA regulations, with a focus on the definition of active efforts, requirements for qualified expert witnesses, hearing notice requirements, and application of the existing Indian family exception. I've posted in the chat line, but for those on the phone, handouts for the presentation can be downloaded from the CJP website, and there are two handouts. One is a PowerPoint presentation, and the second are the guidelines and regulations. And so with that, I'm pleased to introduce Addie, Adrienne Smith, and I will turn it over to her.
Hi, thank you so much. So as previously mentioned, my name is Addie Smith. I, previous to my current position, was the staff attorney at the National Indian Child Welfare Association, and I did an awful lot of work on these guidelines, on comments around the guidelines, on getting the guidelines up and going, and in addition to the regulations. So I'm thrilled to be here and to share with you a little bit about where we've landed now at the very beginning of 2017. So I'm going to flip past the first slide, which is just the title slide. Really briefly, just reminding people why we still need ICWA. This is a question I get all the time. Why do we still need it? Wasn't this important in 78, but not so important now? As you can see, and I don't know if you have the color copy, if you don't have the color copy, the line that in 2008 takes a sharp upward turn, the squares, not the diamonds, represents the disproportionality ratio for American Indian and Alaska Native kids in child welfare. And of course, disproportionality compares the percentage of kids in the child welfare system to the percentage of kids in the general population. And one thing that's really important to understand is that across the board, national studies show that Native kids face abuse or neglect at nearly the same rate as their non-Native counterparts. So if the abuse and neglect rate is about the same for Native kids and other kids, you would imagine then that there should be proportional amounts of Native kids in the child welfare system as there are in the population. And essentially what we see is a ratio of over 2.5, and that means that where nationally Native kids make up about 2% of the kid population, they make up close to 6% of the kids in the child welfare system. So ICWA is really important because, of course, ICWA really aims at making sure that kids are only removed from their families, their communities, and their culture when it's absolutely necessary. And as we'll talk about today, there are various protections that kids in the child welfare system can receive. ICWA's real goal is to say we want to make sure that removal is really only happening when it's absolutely necessary. And as previously discussed by Edie, who did a really great intro, the guidelines and the regulations we're going to talk about really came about because there was a big misunderstanding or a whole lot of differential interpretations or a whole lot of different things happening in different states. So even though it was a federal law meant for uniform application, we were seeing that Native families, depending on what state they were in, were being treated very, very differently. So the purpose of the regs is to try and ensure uniform implementation of this federal law. I'm moving on to slide 3. So I think this is also an important thing to remember as we move into this. Frequently, I hear lots of conversations and comments about ICWA that talk about how it is harmful to Indian kids and families. And what's really interesting is in the past 5 years, what's really come to the fore is that, in fact, ICWA, which was passed in 78, is actually in and of itself the gold standard for child welfare policy. And what does that mean when I say that? What that means is if you watch federal legislation and state legislation on child welfare, starting, of course, with CAPTA in 76, on through what we're seeing now, the bill that Wyden has introduced, the Family First Bill, you see the child welfare system as a whole take steps towards the goals and policies of ICWA. One really good example is in 2008, we saw a move towards kinship care and placement with family and understanding that placement was best. Well, of course, placement with family has been a priority under ICWA since it was passed in 1978. And if we had a more than an hour, we could spend our time just tracing how federal law and state law is starting to catch up to those standards. So you can see in the slide that there are actually a wide number of national policy and practice shops that are saying, look, ICWA is not only good for Indian kids, it's what we should be aiming for all kids. So with that, let's dig in to the meat and potatoes of today's conversation. There's been a lot of ICWA action lately for those who have been paying attention, so I just wanted to lay it out. I'm on slide 4, which is our timeline. And you can see in the 70s some of the statistics that Edie was talking about, the studies that were done saying kids were being removed at an alarming rate. So then in 78, ICWA was passed. Immediately after ICWA's passage, the Bureau of Indian Affairs put together guidelines on ICWA's implementation. Then in 2003, Adoptive Couple Be Baby Girl brought widespread attention back to the Indian Child Welfare Act. It's the second only Supreme Court case ever on ICWA. The first was in 89. It was Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians versus Holyfield. And after attention came back on ICWA and after we saw the Supreme Court take an interesting interpretation on the law, one that in fact we'd never seen before in other state law in a lot of ways, there was this real clear understanding that there wasn't enough information out there to aid practitioners and judges in understanding the purpose, the intent, and actually the letter of ICWA. So the Bureau of Indian Affairs put together a new set of guidelines. So in 2015, guidelines were released for the first time since 79. So I don't know who's on the phone, but I imagine I may have a few practitioners who've been working in child welfare since the early 80s. If you can think about what practice looked like back then versus what practice looks like right now, you can understand why it was really a long overdue for an update on the guidelines. The child welfare system and the dependency or the legal system that runs alongside it have gone through many, many changes. There's been lots more learning and understanding about what works and doesn't work and why. and a lot of legal changes in terms of the rights being protected of parents and kids and the role of the state. And so it's really important to have these updated guidelines to help better track what was actually happening on the ground now. After the guidelines were released, there was a kind of a large outcry from a lot of people saying, look, guidelines are really great, but we know guidelines aren't enough. It's time for some regulations to really provide some enforceable interpretations of the law. So the BIA underwent the process and followed the APA and put together regulations. The regulations were posted. Over 20,000 comments were submitted on the regulations. It is one of the most widely commented on pieces of administrative rule in the year 2015. Someone read all of those, and then of course the final regs were put out. Along with the final regulations, guidelines were reissued that matched the regulations that corresponded with them. So I'm just going to pause here and talk about the second handout really quickly. So what you all have in your what you can click on and get a link to is a tool that the Bureau of Indian Affairs has put together, and it's really what we're going to be walking through today. And what it is it says guidelines for implementing the Indian Child Welfare Act, but if you take a closer look and turn to the substantive pages, you will see that, in fact, what this document does is it integrates the regulations with the guidelines. So I find the table of contents incredibly helpful. It is kind of like a desk reference on ICWA, and it's built around various questions. And so you can see what are the requirements for notice, and you can go to page 30, and what you'll find on page 30 are not only the guidelines on the requirements for notice, but you'll actually see that in big blue lines, the regulations on notice are put forward. And after you read the regulations, you'll see the guidelines that fill in then more details. You can access the guidelines separate from the regulations. So if you wanted to read the guidelines all on their own, they're only about 11 pages. You could very quickly, you know, set aside half of a lunch break and read through all of the regulations. But what I think is really helpful is seeing the guidelines and the regulations side by side, because as you're practicing and as questions of law arise for you, you can turn to this document that I've provided, find the page that corresponds with the question you're asking, and find the answer to the question you're asking, both with regard to the regulations and then the guidelines that fill it out. So I find this to be a really helpful tool. I am going to really focus today on the language of the regulations, but as you'll see, sometimes the regulations could use more clarity, and when that's the case, the guidelines jump in, and so some of what I'll talk about is how the guidelines fill out the regulations. On page 5, just a really quick reminder of the Chevron two-step. So the Chevron test, of course, is all about what do regulations do, what force do they hold, if a statute's ambiguous, and of course there are lots of places where ICWA is ambiguous, where definitions aren't provided, where a provision is unclear, and there's a delegation by Congress, and ICWA contains in its language a delegation that says, please write regulations on this. The language is essentially that clear. Then you go through the formal rulemaking process. As I mentioned, we've been through that. And then the regulation becomes binding. I know a lot of people are really familiar with Chevron and the APA, but it's not too often used in the child welfare world. It's not commonly discussed, certainly in the you know, dependency courtroom. So just a real quick reminder that that's why these regulations are so important. They actually have kind of the force of law. They're legally binding at this point. The guidelines, on the other hand, and there's been lots of commentary on the guidelines since 79, but I thought it'd be most helpful for you all to just take a quick peek at one of your own Wyoming court cases. And your court has said what essentially most courts have said. The guidelines are really helpful, but they're not controlling. So it's really good to be familiar with them. They really exemplify what is best practice in this area. They are They are not mandatory authority. They are persuasive authority that's often looked to and can be very, very helpful. But again, they are distinct from the regulations. But since we have these updated guidelines that are so nicely integrated to the regulations, it's important to be aware of them and to know what they say and don't say. I know I'm actually submitting a brief today to our Court of Appeals here in Oregon where I'm citing to both the regs and the guidelines in a variety of places. So they can be really helpful in a lot of different ways, and they can flesh out what should be doing. Really quickly, and I'm not going to run through this. This is a reference that you all can look to, but what are the levels of legal authority? To the best of our ability, a bunch of the ICWA gurus around the country have come together because now we have all of this authority. We have the federal laws, the state laws, the regs, the guidelines. And from what we can tell, this is what we think the levels of legal authority are, starting with obviously the law and working its way all the way down to the policies and procedures of your own child welfare agency in Wyoming. So this will give you a sense of where to turn first and what to look to first and what level of importance they have. I will say that today, with just 50 minutes, I am really focusing on kind of more globally what the regulations generally say and not how they integrate with what current state case law Wyoming has in place. So we're doing the high level. I'm expecting that those of you on the phone are paying attention to your own case law, have a sense of what it says, and we'll turn to it to see how it integrates with what these new regulations say. So on to page 7, finally into the juicy stuff. Let's just start really quickly with when does ICWA apply. And you'll see that on these slides I'm providing you page numbers. Those page numbers reference you to that big, helpful guidebook on the guidelines and the regs that I've provided. So I have pulled really specific sections of the regulations from that book that, in my opinion, really offer a different course of practice than has historically, kind of generally, nationally been the way that these proceedings have occurred. And that's what I'm highlighting for you. What do I, as someone who's spent years studying ICWA, think the biggest changes are that I want to highlight for practitioners? Like I said, there's lots and lots of detail and description in this guidelines book or this desk reference, as I've kind of said. So there's a lot more there than we're going to talk about today. I'm just kind of pinpointing the juiciest detail. When I send you to a page number, I'm saying, hey, if you have more questions about when ICWA applies and why, these are the pages where you're going to start learning all about everything that the guidelines and the regs really say on this topic. So when does ICWA apply? You will see here that the first thing that I have highlighted for you by putting a little red box around it is what the state court may not consider. And what the regs say explicitly is the state court may not consider factors such as participation of parents in tribal culture, social, religious, or political activities, the relationship the child has with his or her parents, whether the parent has ever had custody of the child, or the Indian child's blood quantum. And this is for the purposes of when the Indian Child Welfare Act applies writ large, the entirety of the act. So everyone on the phone, I'm sure, knows that ICWA applies when you have, one, an Indian child, two, in a child custody proceeding. Both Indian child and child custody proceeding are defined by the act itself. There are a series of courts that over the years have tried to make various claims that even when you have met both of those criteria, it is an Indian child, meaning a member or a child eligible for membership with a parent who is a member, and a child custody proceeding, foster care, TPR, adoptive, pre-adoptive placement. ICWA still does not apply because, and the because in different states has been because of their relationship with their parents, because of the issue of custody, because of the child's blood quantum. And that has become to be known as the existing Indian family exception. The existing Indian family exception was a end run around ICWA. This, without explicitly saying it, forbids the various tests that have been used to prevent ICWA's application when you have met the requirements of ICWA, Indian child in a child custody proceeding. So in a lot of words, it says the existing Indian family exception is not the appropriate interpretation of the Indian Child Welfare Act. It's not in line with the legislative history. It's not in line with the intent, the purpose, or the language, which reminds us, you know, it's always a good reminder to know that the only person who can determine ICWA's application, meaning whether or not the child is a member, or eligible for membership with a parent who's a member, is in fact the child's tribe. And we're going to talk about that a little more when we go into the notice and identifying sections, but just a reminder. The other thing I've highlighted on here that I think is really important is exactly what I was talking about before when we were saying some of what the regs and the guidelines do is just bring ICWA up to speed with current practice. So in 78, there were no states that provided any type of child welfare services to children after 18. As people on the phone likely know, there's been a big effort, especially in the last decade, to extend services to kids up to 21, 23, even sometimes 26 when it comes to health care. So this just says that, listen, if you're in a state where you have extended child welfare services and proceedings are continuing to occur for that kid, ICWA doesn't stop applying just because the kid turns 18. ICWA applies throughout the duration of the case, however long that case may be in your state. So those are some of the big changes about ICWA's application that I think are really important. Moving on to slide 8. So slide 8, how do we know, how are we identifying that a child is an Indian child, which we've now said about 100 times is the key to the application of ICWA? When does it apply to my case? Well, what's really important is the regs say that, look, a court has to help determine if there's reason to know. So reason to know is key. Reason to know if a child is an Indian child. And I want to highlight a couple things about this. That the reg does. So one, this is really, really key. This is a big change in practice for a lot of states. State courts should be asking each participant in the courtroom on the first day of a child custody proceeding, so a foster care proceeding, an emergency proceeding, which we'll talk about in detail later, a TPR proceeding, even if they've asked at them before, the court is to be re-asking each participant, hey, does anyone have reason to know that this could be an ICWA case? And this is really key, and I think some people are seeing this as kind of an onerous requirement to ask in every case this question. But it's really important, and the reason it's really important is if you look historically at the ICWA cases that have caused the most attention and the ICWA cases that have gone the most awry, the real issue in those cases is that the case was not identified as an ICWA case immediately. And so the case proceeded without the protections of ICWA, at which point the issues bubbled up and arose. And because ICWA had not been identified, the case had to start all over with the application of ICWA. So really the problem with ICWA is that's misunderstood in particular by the media that we see a lot is not that ICWA is the problem. It's that when ICWA is not applied, you have created a problem for that kid and that family. So this regulation is really designed to try and help get in front of that problem and say, look, we're just going to ask in every case. Because that way we are doing our kind of due diligence to make sure that if this is an ICWA case, it is getting applied as soon as possible. So along with that, what this regulation says that is a change in practice for some states is that if there is any reason to know, if there's any suspicion that a child, and I'll talk to you about what reason to know means in just a second, but if there's any suspicion, then you have to treat that child as an Indian child until you have discovered that they are, in fact, not an Indian child. So you have to work to confirm once a reasonable suspicion to know is available, and then you have to treat the kid as an Indian kid, so ICWA applies until you know that the kid is actually not an Indian child. And we'll talk a little bit more again in notice about how, you know, kind of when that end phase is that you know or don't know. But this is a really different practice for a lot of states. And I've gotten some questions on this, and of course, as we've discussed, ICWA is the gold star standard. It really works to keep families together and to support families and to promote kids' continued connection with their communities. So sometimes people say to me, well, isn't that unfair? And I think to myself, well, I guess the only thing that's unfair about it is that some kids who shouldn't be are getting extra protections and are getting, you know, treated with the gold star standard when they shouldn't be. And you know, God forbid that our system actually provide extra care for kids and families on accident. So I think that's a really, really important thing to know. Now, what is reason to know? Of course, if the court's asking, it's any participant that has any sense that this child may be an Indian child. So if anyone has said anything to you about that, if anyone has discussed their native ancestry or their history, those would be important questions for all players in the courtroom to now be asking, whether it's DHS, whether you're the parent's attorney, whether you're the GAL, you want to be able to turn to the court and honestly say, I do not or I do have reason to know. So it's something that needs to be integrated into everyone's practice now to be asking on every case. Things to consider are, has a child ever been domiciled on or near a reservation? Has a child ever been the ward of a tribal court? These are questions we don't always think to ask. Does the child have an identification card? And what is the family history of the child? Is there any native ancestry? So those are the types of things to be thinking about. So identifying an Indian child. On to page 9. What are the notice requirements? So notice is one of the most fraught areas of ICWA. It's where I tend to get the most questions. I'm going to start here and really just talk about involuntary proceedings. Our last slide is voluntary proceedings, and there's a little bit of a difference in the notice requirements. So put your head, put on your involuntary hat, so to speak. We're not talking about a voluntary foster care placement or a voluntary adoption. We are talking about a child welfare case here, an involuntary case. In an involuntary case, where the court knows or has reason to know that an Indian child is involved, notice about proceedings must be sent. Notice must be sent before the foster care placement and before the termination of parental rights. So notice has to be sent. Now the regulations talk about really specific timing for that notice, and it's in the statute as well. We're not going to get into the detail of numbers, but for those on the phone, and I have a sense that we have some of the AG's office on the phone, it'd be really important to review the timelines that are required. They're not different, but it's always good to have those in your head and make sure that you're sending notice on time. Here are some changes to be aware of. One, registered or certified mail. So the statute itself says registered mail return receipt. Here, upon the request of many states, that's been changed to registered or certified mail with return receipt based on issues of cost. Something important to note about that, questions I get a lot, what if we do personal service in our state? Personal service, fine, great, totally allowed. Email service, fine, great, totally allowed. But neither of those supplant the requirement for registered or certified mail return receipt. They do supplement it. So by all means, reach out to the tribe by phone. Reach out to the parents by phone. Go in person to meet with them as soon as removal has occurred or within the timelines before the foster care proceeding. But please follow up with registered mail return receipt or certified mail return receipt and make sure that that makes it into the court file and the case file. Because that is very clearly what ICWA requires, and something I often tell people to think about, and those of you in Wyoming are probably more familiar about this than some of the other presentations, but especially with regard to Alaska and some of the other more rural tribes and reservations that I've worked with, certified mail return receipt or registered mail is really important because email is spotty, phone connections are spotty depending on the weather. Getting in touch with people is not guaranteed with the exception of kind of U.S. mail. And so it's always important to make sure that you've sent that to make sure that the tribe is on notice. Notice needs to include requisite information. Again, whole lot of details in the regs about what that requisite information is. I'm not going to go over them with you, but I'm going to point you to the section. You can see the box on here so that people can follow up and make sure that the notice that is being sent is complete and necessary and is following things. Couple more things I want to point out before we move on to the next slide. You've got to send both to the tribe and to the regional director. So both to the tribe and to the regional director. People keep saying, oh, that's new. That's actually not new. There was a tiny handful of ICWA regulations that were passed in the late 70s that included this that didn't get a lot of attention. So this is the same, but for some people it's a nice reminder. You need to be sending both notices to the tribe and to the regional director, even if you know who the tribe is. And part of the reason behind this, because people keep asking me kind of why, if you know who the tribe is there are not a lot of data collection requirements under ICWA or other federal law with regard to ICWA. So even getting a sense of the number of ICWA cases out there has been really challenging and really hard. And so part of this is for data keeping purposes and to fill in what's going on under ICWA and how is it working and where are kids located from different tribes. So when you have to send to the regional director, in that big packet you have the guidelines and regs that I sent you. If you go to Appendix A, it has the exact location of which director to be sending it to based on who the tribe is that you are reaching out to. So you can find that really, really easily. And it's really important that when you do send to the regional director, especially if the tribe is unknown. So let's pause for a second and say, well, what if it's the opposite, where you have a sense, you have reason to know, right, that the child is an Indian child, but you're not sure yet which tribe. Then the notice goes to just the regional director, and it's the regional director's obligation to do their best to try and help you figure out which tribe and how to contact that tribe. And it's their obligation to let you know where they are in that process under a certain set of timelines and what more information they need from you or how much more time they need so that you can effectively relay that to the court. In this situation. So just so you know, it's really important, and the guidelines talk about this, if you document the genealogy of the family before sending it to the regional director so they can have a better sense of who this family is connected to. The other thing that's really important is that the BIA is not going to determine membership. So in the past, there have been some practices where you send notice to the BIA and the BIA sends a notice back saying this kid is or is not a member. All the BIA is really going to help you do is figure out which tribe. It's going to help you engage in diligent efforts to determine which tribe. If the regs and the guidelines speak to this, if you have engaged in diligent efforts to contact the tribe, to contact the BIA, you are not getting information back, or the BIA is saying they're unable to help you determine which tribe. It's very important to keep all of that information, because at that point, it is the onus of the court to make a determination about whether or not this is an Indian child. So although it's the tribe's ultimate decision who is a member, who is an Indian child, if attempts to reach out to the tribe and work with the BIA to determine the tribe and reach out to the tribe fail, then the court should look to ensure that diligent efforts were made to do so and can make a determination about whether or not the child is an Indian child. So that kind of circles back to our conversation about you're going to be treating the child as an Indian child until determined otherwise. Determined otherwise might be because you get a letter back saying this is not, you know, a member or a kid eligible for membership, or it may be after diligent efforts, you're simply unable to determine that fact, and the court makes such a finding. Whew. So notice always includes a lot of information, so that's notice. And I will be trying to hold just a couple minutes at the end for questions, so don't hesitate to take notes and send me some questions towards the end, because I know this is a whole lot of information coming your way in a short amount of time. So we're going to move on to slide 10, active efforts. This is a really fun one. This is probably where you'll see my social work side come out just a little bit more. So active efforts was before undefined. So a couple things I want to highlight. The definition itself is really key. It's especially key for any of my caseworkers who may be on the phone listening. Affirmative, active, thorough, and timely efforts intended to maintain or reunite an Indian child with his or her family. So affirmative, active, thorough, and timely, right? The key, and we saw this in a lot of case law coming up to the regulations, is these efforts aren't passive. They aren't, here's what you should be doing, best of luck on your case plan. They aren't, here's a referral, good luck, let us know how it goes, make sure you make it happen. They're affirmative, thorough, timely, and active, right? They're the opposite of passive. What this definition does not do that is worth noting, and state courts have done this, and that, of course, is appropriate, but it does not directly compare active efforts to reasonable efforts. And the reason for that is actually that the Bureau of Indian Affairs has no authority to make any statements on what the definition of reasonable efforts is, because, of course, reasonable efforts is a Title IV-E term, and the agency that administers Title IV-E is DHHS. Not BIA. And so this was a little bit of a turf war. And by comparing active efforts to reasonable efforts, there were some questions about, you know, whether the BIA had any authority to make commentary about a term that's a part of a rule that isn't there, or I'm sorry, part of a law that isn't their law to administer. And there's some commentary on this in the guidelines. But the key here and kind of what the guidelines point you to based on this regulations definition is it's not about comparing the two. It's really about making sure the efforts that are happening meet this definition. A couple other things I want to highlight about active efforts. This is a really highly litigated issue. So some things to think about. You see on here the definition gets filled out, you know, talking about, you know, walking through the steps of a case plan, helping with access, developing resources. So really working closely with the family. That's, of course, because what studies in the 70s showed and what studies now show is that often Native parents are put on case plan tracks that lead more quickly to removal, TPR, and adoption, whereas we see their non-Native counterparts, and particularly white children in the child welfare system, who are more frequently given more access to more services that lead towards in-home plans and reunification. And so this is really just to remind people that that historically the pattern of treatment of Native families leads to current inadequacies in service provision. And so we need to do extra efforts to make sure that there is balance and that families are all being treated fairly in the child welfare system. Also, it talks about how there are unique considerations for Native families, cultural and social conditions. So making sure that treatment is meeting the cultural needs of families. And this isn't just because this is what ICRA requires, and this isn't just because it is something that that tribes and Native families have said is important. It even goes beyond that. So, you know, there is a lot of traditional wisdom around the importance of culture in the well-being of Native kids and families. That traditional wisdom has now also been backed up by the literature, by science. Native kids and families actually are more engaged, do better, and have better outcomes when the service is culturally grounded and when the service meets not only their mental health needs or their needs as assessed, but also their cultural needs and their various needs for balance and well-being. So you're actually going to end up with better outcomes for kids and families when you're ensuring that the service provided is provided in a culturally competent, culturally relevant manner. So that's what you see there. We're going to move on to page 11. Page 11 gives us some really great details. So what does active efforts look like? Really important to remember, this is not a checklist, right? You just don't pull this out and put together what we sometimes refer to as a cookie-cutter case plan, right? This is not the cookie-cutter case plan for an ICWA case. It's not a checklist. The regs are really clear. The guidelines are really clear. Active efforts need to be tailored to the circumstances of the case. What does this family need to prevent removal? Or if removal has occurred, what does this family need to promote reunification? Some that I see often, having done this work for a couple years, that really stand out to me are 3, 4, 10, and 11. And I'm just pointing those out because these are things that are key to active efforts that I don't see in a lot of the case plans I review, that I don't hear about when I work with state DHS offices as coming naturally to caseworkers to think about. So, you know, really making sure that you're working with the tribe, participating with the tribe, running things by the tribe, understanding the resources that the tribe has to offer in determining what this family needs and how to best serve them if the tribe is working closely on the case. Along with that comes the idea of really building relationships with tribal staff and working closely with tribal ICW units or family preservation programs or the various titles that they have. I think a lot of times I've worked with caseworkers who said, well, the tribe won't really get back to me. And I said, well, have you ever reached out to the tribe any sooner than the night before you need a response on something because you have to be in the court tomorrow and you want to make sure that they agree with you? Have you ever, you know, driven over and visited the tribal offices? Have you ever sat down and had coffee with the tribal caseworker that you have 10 different cases with? It's really important to understand that the tribe is a part of the team here, and having more people around the table who care about the kid and family is great for that kid and that family. And so building those relationships and building that into the work that you do is really highlighted in this active effort. Also, diligent search, looking for the family. I think a lot of people, especially after 2008's fostering connections, are getting much better about doing family searches and looking for family placements. But what doesn't often happen is working with the family as a service provider. So can grandma be the respite care provider? Can grandma be the transportation to and from visits? Can auntie supervise the visits? Can auntie help be a peer mentor or a parenting mentor to dad who's having a hard time figuring out how the parenting classes he's in actually apply in his circumstance? So seeing the family and the extended family as real resources and not just as placement resources but as service providers, and I think that's really key. And 10 and 11, 10 is, I think, my favorite because this is what I hear a lot is, well, we called the treatment provider and they didn't have room for 3 months. So, but we did active efforts because we called and we got placement in 3 months. What can you be doing in those 3 months to make sure that everything possible is being wrapped around that family to help move that parent towards treatment? Is it helping that parent get into an NA or an AA class before they can get into treatment? Is it helping that parent get a sponsor who is someone from their tribe who has been through what they've been through? Is it helping them find a parent mentor who's made it through the child welfare system and has come out with their kids intact on the other side? Are there alternative ways to address the needs of kids and families? And I think this is something that that we often see being especially important in more rural areas where the services are more limited, and so some of the things that caseworkers are used to having access to in bigger cities, thinking about how to provide similar supports and services. So I think this list of examples is good, and it always churns all kinds of thoughts and ideas about things you've done in the past that worked really, really well and maybe you've forgotten about, or new ideas about how to work forward in the future. But of course, if the goal is to really keep kids and families together, whenever possible, active efforts are key before the kid is removed and then working towards reunification. All right, on to the next page, page 12, QEWs. So qualified expert witnesses, what are they? The important thing here, the take-home message is, and I have it in a box, I'm trying to key you guys in on some of the changes, needs to be someone with prevailing social and cultural standards of the child's tribe. So one of the misunderstandings that I get a lot that I think this helps clarify and the guidelines that talk about it really do the same are this idea that, well, but the issue that this kid's really struggling with here is, or that this family's really struggling with here is that mom has real intense mental health needs, right? Mom has real, so we're going to bring in an expert to talk about, who has done an evaluation on mom to talk about how those mental health needs are really going to prevent mom from effectively parenting. That is great. You can have a battle of the experts till the cows come home. You can have 15 experts on each side. But if it is an ICWA case, one of those experts who is presented by the state, it's the state's burden, it's the state's obligation, one of those experts needs to come into the courtroom and be able to talk about whether or not continued custody by the parents is likely to result in serious emotional or physical damage to the child based on the cultural standards of the community from which this family comes from, right, from the Indian Child's Tribe. And the reason that this was put together, I think sometimes this helps people, is that, you know, in the 70s, there were lots of courts that were making lots of decisions about Indian kids and family, and the judges were unfamiliar with tribal culture, tribal parenting standards, tribal child-rearing practices. So this was put into ICWA to say, okay, if you're going to be in state court, if that's the jurisdiction that is appropriate in this case, at very least before removal occurs and before TPR occurs, someone who's familiar with the culture of the child's tribe needs to take a look at that file, needs to work with that family, meet that kid, and say to the court, yeah, you know what, actually here, this is culturally appropriate. So that's the key, and this is one of the sections of ICWA that kind of has been the most differently interpreted across the various states. But the key here is it's really got to be someone familiar with the standards of the child's tribe who is saying culturally this is appropriate. This is not how we parent. This is unacceptable. We agree removal here should occur. We agree that TPR is appropriate, et cetera. So that's who. The other thing I want to key in on is C. We're seeing less than this, but even 5 years ago, it was really very, very common for the social worker working on the case to be the qualified expert witness as well. The guidelines talk a lot about how, in fact, the legislative history of ICWA makes it really clear that the point is that it shouldn't be the same social worker. And the guidelines themselves go so far as to say, really, it shouldn't be anyone from the agency. It needs to be someone from outside the agency who is qualified as an expert who can come in and bring that tribal perspective to the courtroom so that the court can weigh that in their determinations and their decisions about what is best for the child and whether continued custody is necessary or TPR is appropriate. On to page 13. I'm trying to keep an eye on the clock, so I apologize for pushing us through really quickly, but we really only have three key concepts to talk through. Emergency proceedings. This is really important. I don't know if people have been following, but this was just recently and continues kind of to be litigated in South Dakota. It was the Oglala Sioux Tribe versus Van Hunnik case, and it was the big question of what parts of ICWA, if any, apply at emergency proceedings. And I'm not sure what they're called in Wyoming. They're often called protective custody hearings, probable cause hearings, shelter hearings, preliminary hearings, emergency hearings. They have all kinds of names across the country. But what the guidelines really clarify is this. 1922 of ICWA applies to all Indian children if there is a need for emergency removal. So, 1922 should be applied at the initial removal proceeding, that kind of due process check that happens before you have your full adjudication on the petition, but just that first hearing that makes sure that, yes, in fact, removal was necessary and lawful, right? Interfering with the parent's constitutional right to care, custody, and control of their children is valid here because, in fact, there is a risk to the child. And the risk that's defined by ICWA that the regulations really clarifies what you see next, where it says kind of C2, what's that threshold? And it's necessary to prevent imminent physical damage or harm to the child, right? That's in ICWA itself. I think the other thing that's really important to realize about the standard is that, in fact, it's not only in ICWA, but the 2nd, 9th, and 11th, among other and other federal districts, have said, in fact, this is the constitutional federal law standard for emergency removal. So this isn't just ICWA. This is actually the federal constitutional law standard for emergency removal of any child. So it's not out of thin air. It's not this necessarily new, crazy, higher standard. It's been around in ICWA for a long time, applied in different states, and it's certainly that federal law constitutional standard. Some keys to know about that. The guidelines, so there were 2015 guidelines that I briefly mentioned but haven't brought up a lot because I don't want to totally confuse people, but the 2016 guidelines don't provide a clear and concise definition of imminent physical damage or harm. What they do provide is snippets of language from different federal decisions to help people understand what this imminent physical damage or harm to the child means. So those can be really helpful. The guidelines can be really helpful for courts who are trying to interpret what is the threshold here, what is imminent physical damage or harm to the child, what is that line? And so you can look to the guidelines for more guidance on precisely what this means. There is also, and I haven't included it here, but I want to highlight it for people. There is also in the regs 23.113, and it's just page 24 of that bigger booklet that I've given you, a clear definition of how these hearings need to be happening. So when I say that, I say, what needs to be in the petition and what findings does the court need to make when participating in the emergency removal of an Indian child? And a few key things about that are, one, not surprisingly, you have to try and identify whether there's reason to believe the child is an Indian child, because at that point, of course, these ICWA requirements would kick in. The other thing that's really important to know is emergency proceedings are not meant to, and I'm going to get it right this time, supplant the foster care proceeding requirements. They supplement them. So at that 72-hour hearing, or however many hours it is in your state, it's different in every state. It's 24 in Oregon. It's 72 in South Dakota. It's 20 days in Montana, and any range in between. But at that first initial hearing, there is a general understanding that not all the due process rights can be applied, because it needs to happen post haste to ensure the protection of kids. But key here, big change, is that the emergency proceeding says, yes, you can remove a child without all the due process requirements, but rather the 1922 requirements. However, within 30 days, a proceeding with all the due process rights must occur. Okay, so I know here in Oregon, for example, we have our 24-hour hearing, and then our standard of practice is 60 days until we have what we call our jurisdictional or adjudication hearing. This is going to require a change of practice. If the court can show and make findings that there continues to be imminent harm, transfer to tribal court is not possible, and there was not an ability to have a child custody proceeding, then the emergency removal can proceed longer than 30 days, but those three findings need to be made by the court in order to justify a longer period or lag time between the two. Okay, I am really running against the clock, so let's be really quick to hit these last three and give a couple minutes for questions. On to page 14 or slide 14, placement preferences, good cause. The most heavily litigated area of ICWA, period, across the board, everywhere. Few things to know. The party who is asserting that there's good cause to not follow the placement preferences, and I'm just going to assume that people know that there are placement preferences both for foster care and for adoption proceedings, that if there is reason to not place in accordance with those placement preferences, you can do so by showing good cause. The party asserting that the placement preferences should not be followed must prove by clear and convincing evidence why they can't be followed. And here are the big ones that are yeses, so reasons that you may not follow them. One, people have talked to the parents about what ICWA requires, and the parent still says, no, this is the home that I want my child to be in. A child is of sufficient age, and of course that varies by state, so you'll need to know your state law on that, but is of sufficient age and capacity to say, look, I get what the preferences are. I really want to be placed with this individual. There's a need to keep siblings attached, or there are extraordinary physical, mental, or emotional needs. So I think the key word here is extraordinary, that make it such that the general placement preferences aren't provided, and you can't find anyone who can provide for those needs who's within the placement preferences. And lastly, there has been a diligent search. Everyone has tried and done everything to try and find someone within the placement preferences and come up short. And there, of course, is why it's important to keep long, intense case notes about all the diligent efforts that have been taken to try and meet the placement preferences but not been able to. Next page, slide 15, we may even make it. These are key, okay? key. These are vetoes. These are no longer reasons for avoiding good cause on the placement preferences, right? Socioeconomic status. And I think the key to this term is that we see this, but we see it in veiled language all the time. So when you have two options, one home is the placement preference home and it is of a lower socioeconomic status, one home is not in the placement preference home. Sometimes what we see, for example, in presented in court are the ability to send the child to private school, the ability to provide a good home for that child, just being really clear that although those things may be nice, they do not make necessarily for a good home or better parenting, and they do not certainly trump the placement preferences and the value of keeping a child connected to their family, to their community, to their culture. And the last one, and the one that takes just a quick explanation, is really can't be based solely on ordinary bonding and attachment that flowed from time in the non-preferred placement. Okay, so we know, we've seen it, we've seen the trainings where attorneys are being told, just go ahead, place them in a non-equal placement. By the time the appeal comes around, we will be able to argue that that kid has bonded. And so even though it was a non-equal placement, they should remain there. So really the point of this is to say to practitioners, you've got to follow the rules of ICWA. They are federal law, and you can't do this end run around ICWA and come back later and say that bonding is the issue when the fact that bonding is the issue is because you didn't follow ICWA to begin with. And you'll see the key word is, you know, this is only when things were done in violation of the Indian Child Welfare Act, which I think is really strong language. All right, on to our last slide. I just want to point out one thing. I'm trying to hit the highlights. Voluntary proceedings. I'm sure that people know that under voluntary proceedings, ICWA applies. There are provisions specific to voluntary proceedings. That's often a misunderstanding. ICWA applies there for sure. What is different is there's no explicit notice provision in ICWA for voluntary proceedings in the statute itself. And this has been discussed a lot in the last few years. What's important, though, is if you think it through logically, if you have to apply ICWA in a voluntary proceeding involving an Indian child, you still have to figure out if there's reason to know or reason to believe that a child is an Indian child. You'll see the language here is reason to believe. And if that is the case, then the court must ensure that you've taken reasonable steps to verify the status. Of course, nearly the only way to verify the Indian status of a child is to contact the tribe who determines its own membership and verify whether or not the child is, in fact, a member or eligible for membership so that you know that ICWA needs to be followed. So just key, notice in its most formal format is not required. However, this verification step is not excused just because it's voluntary. Of course, and this is the next sentence stated here, respecting the desire of anonymity of a parent is key, just like under involuntary proceedings, respecting state laws around confidentiality is key. And ICWA does not allow permission to kind of open the floodgates and ignore those requirements or those requests from parents. And so that is just a reminder here that anonymity must be respected and the tribe must be made aware so that they can also participate in protecting that parent. And I think we actually made it through a large amount of information in a pretty short amount of time and have just a couple minutes left. So I will hand it over for a wrap-up. I really thank you all for your time. I'm really excited to watch these new regs roll out. They've only been effective now for almost 2 months, so there's a lot more that needs to be done about educating them. I know in Oregon and in Michigan and a few other states, people are keeping extra copies in their briefcases so when they're in court on ICWA cases, they can hand them to the judge and hand them out and say, I'm not making this stuff up. This is real, but it is brand new, and I really appreciate it. For more information, there are a few great places to go, NICWA.org, NICWA.org. There's NARF.org, which is the Native American Rights Fund, and of course there's the ICWA Appellate Clinic at Michigan State Law School, and there are people at all three of those places who can help answer more questions and guide you along the way, in addition to the Bureau of Indian Affairs in D.C. Thank you so much.
All right, Addie, one quick question. This is in the chat room. If there is a custody litigation involving the parents, then ICWA does not apply, correct? as between two parents, ICWA does not apply. So we're just confirming. That's correct, right?
Yes. That is a great question. That's right. Custody disputes between two parents, it does not apply. That's in the regulations, and it's also in the guidelines. So really good question. This is about when there's a third party entering into the family. So whether that be an adoptive placement, step-parent adoption, or a child welfare proceeding. Really good question.
Great. And with that, I think we're out of time. Anything you want to lead us with or leave us with, Addie? And thank you again.
I think if there were anything that I were to leave you with, it's just get out there. You are now a team of educators who know more about the federal regulations than I think probably 95% of child welfare practitioners currently in Wyoming or in the country in general. So I hope that you will now become stewards of this new information and help others learn more and better understand the importance of ICWA and what all these new rules really help us understand.
Wonderful. So thanks, everybody that tuned in to listen. Our next episode will be March 9th, and that title of that presentation is Educational Issues for Children in the Child Welfare System. So thanks again, and everyone have a great day.